Imagine a highway system. But I'm not talking about asphalt and concrete here.
Right.
I'm talking about a highway for chemistry. It has absolutely no speed limits, no traffic lights, and it has direct, unmediated access to the most vital infrastructure of a city.
Which is a pretty wild concept when you really think about it.
It is, because if you send a delivery truck down this road, say a truck full of life-saving antibiotics, it arrives instantly. It's a miracle of logistics.
But the flip side of that speed is just as dramatic and honestly, much scarier.
Yeah, exactly.
You
Because
know.
if you send a bomb down that road, there's no time to call the bomb squad. There's no time to evacuate the buildings. It's already there.
That is a terrifying but actually a scientifically perfect description of intravenous therapy.
We call them IVs. It's such a routine part of a hospital visit for so many of you listening, right? You go in, you get a poke, you get a bag of fluids. But today, we're stripping away that routine to look at the high-stakes reality underneath. We're doing a deep dive into the ability to bypass the body's natural defenses, the skin, the stomach acid, the liver, and put potent chemicals directly into the systemic circulation.
It is modern medicine's fast lane.
Yeah.
You are skipping the line and going straight to the source.
But here is the catch, and this line from the nursing text we're looking at asked, it actually gave me pause. It says, "Once a drug enters the bloodstream, its action cannot be stopped."
Yeah, that's the core tension of this entire deep dive today.
Right.
There is no undo button on an IV push. You cannot reach back into the vein and pull the medication out once that plunger is down. The
Wow.
moment it leaves the syringe, it belongs to the patient's physiology.
So our mission today is to decode how medical professionals manage that no undo button reality. And for you guys listening, we have a really serious stack of documents
We
here.
do.
We're looking at the Island Health Thor drug monographs, which look like standard forms but read like legal statutes. We have specific nursing policy documents on infusion types.
And we're cross-referencing all of that with two major heavy hitters. We've got Lewis on pathophysiology and Assel on clinical skills.
Exactly. So we're going to break this down into three layers. First, the rigorous safety protocols, the rules of the road that keep the highway safe. Second, the biology of what happens when that road creates a crash, specifically the mechanics of shock.
Right.
And finally, the powerful pharmacology used to bring a patient back from the brink.
Let's start with the rule book.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
So I pulled up this document called the IV Monograph from the Island Health Source.
Okay.
And when I first opened it, I was expecting like a how-to guide, you know, insert tab A into slot B.
Sure.
But reading it closely, it feels a lot more like a flight manual for a fighter jet.
That is exactly the right headspace to be in.
Yeah.
In clinical practice, the monograph isn't a suggestion. It is a rigid safety framework that borders on actual law. And the text makes a really critical distinction right at the beginning that I think a lot of people just miss. It separates general guidelines from what they call the gray shaded areas.
The gray shaded areas. It sounds kind of mysterious, but in the text, it's incredibly blunt.
It's totally emphatic. The document states that anything in a gray shaded box is policy.
Okay.
That means it is mandatory. It's not, you know, use your clinical judgment or see how the patient feels. It is, you must do this, or you are operating outside safety standards.
And one of the first gray boxes is labeled, "Who may give?" Now, I admit, I kind of assumed if you're a nurse, you can give IVs. It's just part of the job description, isn't it?
You'd think so, but the monograph is way more granular than that. It outlines very specific skill sets. It differentiates between a general registered nurse and those with specialized skills.
No, interesting.
Okay, for instance, a general RN might administer standard antibiotics or fluids,
Yeah.
but something like an epidural or certain chemotherapy drugs,
Right.
that requires a completely different certification.
So it's strictly matching the complexity of the drug to the competency of the provider.
Correct. And it protects the patient from the unknown unknowns. A general nurse might not know the subtle warning signs of an epidural complication until it's just way too late.
Oh, wow.
So the policy ensures the person pushing the plunger knows exactly what to look for.
That makes total sense. Another section that really grabbed me was compatibility. The text warns that absolute statements are difficult because of buffering systems and preservatives,
Yeah.
but the gist is basically you can't just mix things together in the same tube.
This is where chemistry meets biology. And it gets incredibly messy. If you mix the wrong two liquid medications in an IV line, they don't just sit there, they can physically react.
Right.
They might change color, which is obviously bad, or they might precipitate.
Which essentially means they turn into rocks, right? Inside the tube.
Microscopically, yes. They're creating crystals or solids. Imagine injecting tiny shards of glass or sand into a patient's vein.
That is horrifying.
It is. It can damage the kidneys, block capillaries, or cause a massive embolism. That's why the Monograph is so obsessed with checking compatibility. It's not just about whether drug A stops drug B from working. It's about whether drug A plus drug B creates an actual poison.
Right. Then there's the rate of administration. And this isn't just about, you know, time management on the ward. The ASL text has this warning box that says pushing a drug too fast can cause fatal cardiac dysrhythmias or circulatory overload.
Because speed kills in this context.
Yeah.
Think about how the heart works for a second. It runs on electrical signals, ions moving in and out of cells.
Okay.
If you take a drug that affects heart rate or blood pressure and you slam it into the system in 2 seconds, you are shocking that entire electrical grid.
It's like a power surge.
Exactly. The heart just can't adjust. It can go into a chaotic rhythm or it can just stop entirely.
And what about circulatory overload?
That's the other major risk. It's literally putting too much fluid into the pipes too fast. The heart can't pump it fast enough, and so the fluid backs up into the lungs. You essentially drown the patient from the inside.
Man. So the Monograph is basically the pre-flight checklist that prevents this whole no undo button scenario from becoming a tragedy.
Precisely. It forces the clinician to slow down. It turns a purely mechanical task into a cognitive one. You have to stop, read the gray box, and actually think before you act.
Okay, let's move from the rule book to the actual mechanics. How do we physically get these drugs into the highway?
Good question.
The ASL text breaks down 4 methods, and I want to walk through them with you because the risk profile changes drastically with each one.
Sure. You start with the safest, which is large volume infusions.
That's the classic bag on a pole that we always see in the movies.
Right. You're mixing medication into maybe 500 milliliters or a liter of fluid. It drips in slowly over an hour or two. It's safe because it's so diluted.
Makes sense.
If the patient has a reaction 5 minutes in, you just stop the drip. You've only given them a tiny fraction of this total dose. You actually have time to react.
Okay, then you have the piggyback, which the text says is just a smaller bag attached to the main line, and the mini pump. But then you have the one that seems to carry the most weight in the reading, the IV push or bolus.
Right, and ASL explicitly labels the IV push as the most dangerous method.
Why is the push so much more dangerous than the big bag? Is it purely just the concentration?
It's concentration and time. With a push, you have a syringe with the full dose. It's highly concentrated. You're injecting it directly into the circulation over maybe 1 or 2 minutes.
Okay.
Once it leaves that syringe, it is all in the patient.
Like we said earlier, there's no taking it back.
None. If you calculated the dose wrong, if you grabbed the wrong vial, or if the patient happens to be allergic, the full force of that error hits them immediately. There is absolutely no buffer. Right. The body has to deal with the full impact instantly.
Speaking of buffers, there's a specific check mentioned in the ASL text for the IV push. That sounds a bit, well, it sounds a bit vampiric. The blood return check.
It does sound weird, but it's not just a suggestion. It's a vital safety step. Before you push that plunger to inject the drug, you actually pull back on it gently.
Wait, you want to suck blood out?
Just a tiny bit. You need to see a flash of blood flow back into the tubing or the syringe.
And if you don't see blood?
Then you stop immediately. Because if you don't get blood return, you might not be in the vein at all. You might be in the tissue surrounding the vein.
Oh.
And this leads us to 2 terms from the text that sound pretty terrifying. Infiltration and extravasation.
Yeah, ASL treats these very seriously. What is the actual difference between them?
So infiltration is when a fluid like saline or maybe a mild antibiotic leaks into the tissue. It causes swelling, coolness. Maybe the patient's arm gets a bit puffy. It's uncomfortable, but usually the body just absorbs it over time.
Okay, so that's manageable.
But extravasation is the nightmare scenario. That happens when a vesicant leaks out.
A vesicant.
A blistering agent. Things like certain chemotherapy drugs or even high concentration electrolytes. If these leak into the muscle and skin, they don't just sit there, they chemically burn the cells.
Wow.
The text warns this can cause sloughing of tissues.
Sloughing, that is a word you literally never want to hear in a medical context.
Definitely not. It means the tissue dies necrosis and literally falls away. It can cause deep ulcers that require serious skin grafts to repair.
Unbelievable.
That's why that blood return check is non-negotiable. You have to know the needle is in the highway, not parked in the living room, so to speak.
Right. Okay, so we've established how we get the drugs in and the extreme dangers of the delivery method. But let's zoom out for a second. Why are we even doing this in the first place?
Exactly.
Usually we're running these massive risks because the body is in trouble. And the Lewis ticks introduces us to the concept of shock.
And this is where we really need to redefine a common word. When you say shock in a non-medical context, you mean surprise or emotional trauma.
Right, like I was shocked by the movie ending.
Exactly. Yeah. But in medicine, shock has a brutal, very specific definition. It is the failure of the circulatory system to supply oxygen to the cells.
The Lewis text has this pathophysiology map that traces the collapse. It's really like watching a slow-motion domino effect. It starts with decreased venous return.
Think of the cardiovascular system as a closed loop. You have a pump, which is the heart. You have pipes, the vessels. And you have a tank, the blood itself. Decreased venous return just means not enough blood is coming back to the pump.
And if the pump is empty,
it can't pump anything out. So decreased cardiac output follows right after. If output drops, your blood pressure crashes. And if pressure crashes, the blood doesn't get pushed into those tiny capillaries that feed your organs.
And that leads to the final step on the map, which is impaired cellular metabolism.
The cells essentially suffocate. They switch to anaerobic metabolism, which creates a bunch of acid, and eventually they die. If you don't reverse it fast, the organs just shut down one by one.
Lewis actually breaks down the types of shock, and I found this part fascinating. You have hypovolemic shock, which is a volume problem. The tank is empty because you've lost blood or fluid.
Right.
But then you have anaphylactic shock.
Anaphylaxis is a plumbing problem.
This is type hypersensitivity. The text describes it essentially as a biological explosion.
It really is an explosion. It starts with IgE antibodies. These are the sentinels of your immune system. In a highly allergic person, these antibodies bind to mast cells. And you can think of mast cells as little landmines filled with chemicals.
So when the trigger, like the allergen, say a peanut or a bee sting, shows up,
the landmines detonate. The mast cells degranulate. They release a massive cocktail of chemicals into the system, histamine, serotonin, leukotrienes.
Okay.
And these chemicals do two catastrophic things to the pipes of your circulatory system. First, massive vasodilation.
The pipes get huge.
Instantly. Imagine a fire hose that suddenly becomes a sewer tunnel, but you have the exact same amount of water flowing through it. The pressure just drops to rock bottom. The blood pools in your extremities and it doesn't get back to the heart.
And what's the second thing?
Increased capillary permeability. The pipes get really leaky.
So you have low pressure, and now the fluid is actually leaking out of the system entirely.
Yes. It leaks out of the blood vessels and into the interstitial space. That's the tissue between your cells. This is what Lewis refers to as third spacing.
Third spacing.
Yeah, the fluid is still technically in your body, but it's totally useless to your heart. It's in the walls of the room, not in the plumbing.
The text mentions a visual sign of this that we've probably all seen, the wheal and flare reaction.
That's the skin manifestation of the leak. That pale, raised, itchy bump the wheal is literally fluid leaking into the skin layers.
Yeah.
Now imagine that exact same process happening inside your throat.
Laryngeal edema. The airway just swells shut.
Exactly. So you have a patient whose blood pressure has bottomed out. Because their vessels are too wide and completely empty, and they can't breathe because their airway is swollen shut. This is the no undo button scenario happening in real time. The body's rapidly failing.
And this is where the rescue comes in. We have this really detailed table of medications from Lewis, and the absolute star of the show seems to be epinephrine.
Adrenaline. It is the ultimate counterattack.
How exactly does it fix the plumbing failure?
It does the exact opposite of the anaphylactic reaction. The allergic reaction caused vasodilation.
Right.
Well, epinephrine causes intense vasoconstriction. It clamps those pipes back down to raise the blood pressure.
Okay.
The reaction caused airway swelling. Epinephrine causes bronchodilation. It relaxes the muscles in the lungs to open the airway right back up.
So it's basically the biological undo button for anaphylaxis.
It is the only undo button that works fast enough. But remember the risks we talked about at the start. The Lewis text specifically warns that overdosing epinephrine can lead to stroke and death, because it raises the pressure so high.
But the text also clearly says, in anaphylaxis, the benefits outweigh the risks.
Because that's the clinical calculation you have to make. The patient is dying right now from shock. We have to risk the severe side effects of the epinephrine to save their life. We trade a potential problem for a guaranteed disaster.
Now, what about the other drugs in the table? We've got norepinephrine, which is often called levofed, and phenylephrine.
Right. These are the heavy lifters for other types of shock. Or if the epinephrine just isn't holding the pressure up, they're classified as alpha-adrenergic agonists.
Translate that for us.
Their main job is peripheral vasoconstriction. They aggressively clamp down on the blood vessels in the extremities, the arms, the legs, the skin, and the kidneys.
Why do we want to clamp down there? Don't those parts of the body need blood?
They do, but not as much as the brain does. The body goes into pure survival mode. It essentially says, I can live without my fingers or my gut for an hour, but I absolutely need my heart and my brain.
Wow.
So these drugs force the blood out of the periphery and shunt it directly to the core.
That perfectly explains the warning in the text about these drugs specifically.
Uh-huh.
It says they should ideally go through a central line.
Yes. Remember when we talked about extravasation earlier?
Yeah, the sloughing.
Right. If norepinephrine leaks out of a tiny vein in your hand and into the tissue, it does its job way too well. It constricts the blood vessels in that tissue so tightly that the blood supply is cut off completely.
So it literally kills the hand.
It causes necrosis.
Yeah.
The tissue dies from lack of oxygen. That's why we heavily prefer a central line. That's a big catheter deep in the chest where the blood flow is incredibly high. It dilutes the drug instantly so it doesn't just burn the vessel wall.
It is absolutely amazing how thin the line is between a life-saving drug and a tissue-destroying poison.
It is entirely about delivery, dosage, and location.
There's one more drug mentioned here for pump issues, dobutamine.
Right. Sometimes the problem isn't the pipes, like in anaphylaxis or the fluid, like hypovolemia. Sometimes it's the pump itself, like in cardiogenic shock after a major heart attack. Dobutamine increases myocardial contractility.
Which basically means it makes the heart beat stronger.
Exactly. It whips the tired horse to get it moving again.
So we have the rule book, the mechanics, the crisis, and the rescue. But here is the fundamental problem. Humans are fallible.
Very.
Nurses get tired. Doctors get distracted. How do we actually stop mistakes from happening when we're dealing with weapons-grade pharmacology on a daily basis?
The ASL text talks a lot about the safety net. It's often called the Swiss cheese model of defense in healthcare.
Swiss cheese?
Yeah, imagine slices of Swiss cheese stacked up next to each other. Each slice represents a safety protocol, and each slice has holes in it, which represent potential errors or oversights.
Okay.
The goal is to stack enough slices together so that the holes never line up perfectly to let an error pass all the way through to the patient.
That's a great visual.
Yeah.
And the most fundamental slice mentioned in the text is the three checks.
This is absolute religion in nursing school. You never, ever just grab a drug and give it. You perform three distinct separate checks.
Walk us through them.
Check one. You check the label against the medication administration, record the MAR, when you pull the drug from the automated dispenser or the shelf. You verify it's the right drug, the right dose, and the right time.
Okay, that's step one.
Check two. You check it again when you're preparing it, like drawing it up into the syringe.
Yeah.
You look at the vial and the syringe side by side. You essentially ask yourself, is this actually what I think it is?
And the third check.
Check three happens right at the bedside. You scan the patient's ID band, you look at the drug label again, and you verify it against the order one last time before it ever touches the patient.
So that third check is the absolute final barrier.
It's the most critical one because it happens right at the point of no return. It catches the error right before that no undo button is pressed.
The text also gets really granular about hygiene and sharp safety. There's this thing called the scoop technique. I had actually never heard of this before.
This one is strictly for the nurse's safety. If you have a clean needle and you need to recap it for a second before use, you never hold the cap in one hand and the needle in the other and try to fit them together in midair.
Because if your depth perception is off by even a millimeter,
you stab your own hand. And if that needle happens to have been in a patient already, you now have a needle stick injury. That means potential exposure to bloodborne pathogens, like HIV or hepatitis.
So you just put the cap on the table.
You put the cap on the table and you physically scoop it up with the needle using only one hand. It looks simple, almost kind of silly when you do it, but it prevents thousands of serious injuries every year.
But even more important for the patient is the needleless system hygiene. The text says you have to scrub the port, the little connection point on the IV tubing itself.
For 15 seconds, or right. Sometimes 30 seconds, depending on the specific cap manufacturer.
15 seconds feels like a surprisingly long time when you're just scrubbing a tiny little piece of plastic.
Try counting it out next time you wash your hands. One Mississippi, two Mississippi, all the way to 15. In a highly busy hospital, when alarms are ringing everywhere and you have five other patients needing you, that feels like an eternity.
I bet.
But if you don't do it, you are literally injecting surface bacteria directly into that bloodstream highway we talked about. You could very easily cause sepsis.
Finally, I want to touch on the scope of practice document, policy 22.1.14. It mentions LPNs, licensed practical nurses. It seems like the system strictly limits who can do what just to prevent systemic errors.
It does. It builds a hierarchy of safety. For example, the policy clearly states an LPN cannot administer potassium chloride stronger than 20 millimoles per liter.
Why pick on potassium so specifically?
Because potassium is another one of those no-undo-button drugs. It regulates the heart's electrical reset. If you give too much potassium or you give too fast, you don't just get an irregular heartbeat. The heart stops entirely. It stays contracted and it simply won't relax.
That's essentially how lethal injection works, isn't it?
It is. So by strictly limiting those high concentrations to RNs or pharmacists, people with much more advanced pharmacology training, the system adds another thick slice of Swiss cheese. It literally removes the option for error from a large group of providers.
So we've traveled from the paper policy to the needle, into the failing circulatory system during shock, and back out to the rescue medications. It is a pretty incredible journey through the body's vulnerabilities.
It really is. It completely changes how you look at a simple IV bag hanging on a pole. You realize it's not just water. It's the direct lifeline that requires immense respect.
What really stands out to me is the deep paradox of it all. 5-E therapy is the absolute most effective way to save a life, like giving epinephrine and anaphylaxis, but it's also the absolute easiest way to cause harm if you mess up an IV push.
And that is the daily burden of the profession. You have these tools that are essentially miracles of science. We can restart hearts. We can clamp blood vessels shut with just a milligram of fluid. But they require absolute, unwavering precision. And actually, the Lewis text had a quote that really stuck with me. It says, anaphylaxis can occur after contact, inhalation, ingestion, or injection.
That is a highly provocative thought.
It reminds us we are constantly interacting with the world chemically. We feel solid. We feel totally separate from our environment. But chemically, we are just a porous, incredibly delicate set of equilibrium reactions.
And in the wrong body, even a totally simple substance, a peanut, a bee sting, or a routine medication can trigger a cascade that requires this entire advanced life support system to stop.
We walk a very fine line between homeostasis and chaos every single day.
Luckily, we have the protocols, the monographs, and the pharmacology to manage that chaos when it inevitably happens. Thanks to everyone for listening to this deep dive into the bloodstream highway. Give it some thought the next time you see that bag on a pole.
Stay safe out there.